You are listening to a podcast from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
Hi, everybody. Sorry to keep you waiting. My name is George Perkovich. I'm the Vice President for Studies here at the Carnegie Endowment. It's my pleasure to welcome you and to admire your perseverance. I think it's worthwhile because few countries have been as important to each other as the U.S. and Pakistan have been since the early 1950s. And yet, as anyone who reads a paper or watches the news knows, the importance of U.S.-Pakistan relations does not make it satisfactory to either country, nor does the importance mean that the two governments trust each other. In Washington, the feeling is that the relationship in the past was broken because Pakistan pursued interests and activities that it knew were contrary to U.S. interests, as in the nuclear program in the 80s, and that Washington would have to pull back. In Pakistan, it's felt increasingly that the United States is a fair-weather friend, and it has abandoned Pakistan before, and it will again. And we see a similar tension here today in the relationship and discourse between the two, a concern that, in fact, the interests are contrary enough that there will be yet another separation. There are a number of elements of mutual frustration, but again, the point of mutual importance remains. Therefore, it's worthwhile to try to explore ways of building shared purposes and understandings, even if mutual trust is a little too much to expect now. There are few people better qualified to address these issues than former President Pervez Musharraf. Pervez Musharraf served in the Pakistani Army for more than 40 years, rising to its highest position, the Chief of Staff. From that position, he took power in Pakistan in 1999 and became president in 2001. He continued as president until 2008. He's a civilian today, but remains keenly well-positioned to address the future of U.S.-Pakistan relations. President Musharraf has been squeezed on the front end in Congress today. He has to go back to the Hill, but he has said that he will spend the assigned time here. He'll make some remarks, and then we'll take plentiful questions from you. So with that, let me ask you to welcome General Musharraf.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. First of all, my profound apologies for being late. I was held back at the Hill. Well, with that, may I express my gratitude to Mr. George Perkovich and the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace for having invited me and given me this opportunity of speaking to such an august gathering. Without much ado, I would like to straight get on to the subject, and I'm going to speak about South Asia, about our region, and about Pakistan. And within that, I must cover, obviously, the United States-Pakistan relations, which have achieved some kind of a criticality at this moment. But talking of South Asia, I would like to start with recapitulating a little bit of history from 1979 onwards, because sometimes our memories are short and we forget about whatever has happened in the region. So that will build the case for what we ought to be doing and what we have now. I will take on the period of 1979-89 first of all. It was 1979 when Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan and occupied Afghanistan. And this created a violation of U.S. policy, which believed in containment of Soviet expansion, and also created alarms in Pakistan, because Soviet Union was trying to get to the warm waters of the Indian Ocean through Pakistan, through balkanizing Pakistan. So therefore, there was a collusion of U.S. and Pakistan interests. And therefore, we thought of assisting Afghanistan in fighting against the Soviet Union. And we decided to launch a jihad. Jihad is a holy war. And when I say we, United States and also Pakistan in the lead role, decided to launch jihad, a holy war, for the reason of attracting mujahideen, holy warriors, from all over the Muslim world. And may I say, we succeeded in drawing about 25 to 30,000 mujahideen from the whole, from the Muslim world, extending from Morocco to Indonesia. And not only that, we recruited, trained, armed Taliban from the tribal agencies of Pakistan and pumped them into Afghanistan. This continued for 10 long years, ladies and gentlemen, this jihad, the holy war with the United States and Pakistan assistance for the people of Afghanistan. The two points that I want to highlight here, which are very significant. Number one, that the elites of Afghanistan abandoned Afghanistan during this period. They came to United States and Europe. And this war against, this jihad against Soviet Union was spearheaded by religious militant groups. This is the one point that we need to understand. The second point is that when the Soviet Union occupied Afghanistan, a year before that, through their own machinations, they deposed the king. Afghanistan was held together through an arrangement called Misak-e-Milli, which translates into a national covenant, a national agreement between all the four major ethnic groups, the Pakhtun, Tajik, Hazaras, and Uzbeks, to live together, stay together, under the sovereignty of the king. But when Soviet Union deposed the king, that glue which held Afghanistan together was no more there. So when we are talking of a political solution, we are talking of creating another Misak-e-Milli, a national covenant, which will hold the country together, which obviously implies a proportional representation of all the ethnic groups, the major ethnic group being Pakhtun. I will talk more about it later. So this much for 79-89. Then comes the period of 89-2001. I generally call this as a period of disaster. Period of disaster because the United States somehow decided to change course and abandon the place. They abandoned that place, Afghanistan, without any rehabilitation, resettlement of the 25,000 refugees armed to the teeth and knowing only to fight. This was unfortunate, and also maybe a shift of policy of Pakistan being put under sanctions. We remember, as far as Pakistan is concerned, the Pressler Amendment, which denied all military assistance to Pakistan, and also a policy towards more tilted towards India, a strategic relationship developing with India. So this was a policy shift, unfortunately. And also, may I say, with this policy shift, because of this policy shift, abandonment of Afghanistan, the Mujahideen, 25,000, 30,000 Mujahideen in Afghanistan, coalesced and became Al-Qaeda. This Osama bin Laden, Zawahiri, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed are all products of the 80s. So the Mujahideen become Al-Qaeda now. And not only that, in 1996, Taliban emerged. Now, while from 89 to 96 in Afghanistan, about 10 ethnic groups all were fighting among themselves. They ravaged the country and destroyed the country. Total anarchy in Afghanistan. But in 1996, it became Taliban, who were all Pakhtuns, versus Northern Alliance, who was Tajik, Uzbek, Hazaras. This continued till 9/11. So total ravaging of the country, destruction of the country. As far as Pakistan is concerned, another element started. Freedom struggle in Kashmir, in Indian-held Kashmir, started in 1989. Its impact on Pakistan was that there were dozens of Mujahideen groups which sprung up from our society inside Pakistan, volunteers preparing, wanting to go into a Indian part of Kashmir to fight the Indian army. So therefore, in effect, why I have highlighted these elements is that religious militancy was introduced by us from in 79, continued till 89, then having abandoned the place by United States, It continued in a different form, all bodies fighting each other, ethnic groups, Taliban emerged, Al-Qaeda became, and Kashmir freedom struggle, Mujahideen in Pakistan, religious militancy from the east, from the west of Pakistan, from the east of Pakistan, Pakistan became a victim of religious militancy. So therefore, my deduction, ladies and gentlemen, Pakistan is not the perpetrator of terrorism. Till 1979, we were in perfectly harmonious situation. All that happened within Pakistan is that we became a victim of circumstances in the region. Then comes 9/11, ladies and gentlemen. Now, after 9/11, there was obviously the terrorist attack here, which was most terrible, and the obvious attack by United States in Afghanistan. My Pakistan joining the coalition. Now, I was on the scene then. I took the decision of joining the coalition in Pakistan's own interest, more than U.S. interest. Pakistan's own interest was that I realized, I knew that Pakistan is a moderate country. Pakistan wants to be a progressive, enlightened, moderate country. And Talibanization and Taliban culture of obscurantist understanding of Islam is not for Pakistan. Therefore, quite clearly, we would not have liked to be on the Taliban side. And therefore, we joined the coalition. Now, here I want to highlight a few blunders en route. The first blunder I say was 1989, when the United States abandoned Afghanistan without rehabilitation, resettlement of the Pakhtuns, of the Mujahideen. The second blunder was in 1996, when Taliban emerged, and Pakistan was the only country which recognized Taliban. And at this moment, I remember back in March of 2000, when President Clinton came to Pakistan, he was persuading me not to deal with Taliban. And I told him at that time that I would suggest a different strategy, that we all recognize Taliban and the world should open missions in Afghanistan and let us then moderate them from within. Certainly, I am not with their ideas of obscurantist ideas, but confronting them or not recognizing them, it is better to recognize them and moderate them from within. That not doing that was the second blunder. Had we done that, maybe we could have saved the Buddha statue or even resolved the Osama bin Laden issue. If there were 100 missions threatening to quit Afghanistan if they did not agree to moderation. So that was the second blunder. Now the third blunder after 9/11 was, I would like to highlight, that after 9/11 with the US attack, coalition attack in Afghanistan, and with Northern Alliance, the Taliban and Al-Qaeda were defeated. They ran helter-skelter into Pakistan, into the mountains and cities of Pakistan. There was a vacuum in Afghanistan, a political vacuum. Here was the situation where the military had delivered. Military of United States delivered victory to you. But this military victory had to be converted into a political victory. And political victory meaning that a proportional, ethnically proportional, balanced, legitimate government to be placed in Kabul. Now this was the time when, from a position of strength, we could have done that. When we say ethnically balanced, proportional government, we had to have Pakhtun on board. It had to be Pakhtun dominated because Pakhtun have always ruled Afghanistan and 50% of Afghanistan is Pakhtun. So, while all Taliban were Pakhtun, I coined a term that all Pakhtun are not Taliban. So, we must wean away Pakhtuns from the Taliban and give them the dominant position in government in Kabul. This was not done. To date, it has not been done. To date, dominant position of governance in Afghanistan is by Tajiks and a section of Tajiks which are called Panjshiris, who are 8% of Afghanistan. Now, I personally feel that this window of opportunity that I am talking of persisted from 2002 till early 2004 for 2 long years. Taliban, Al-Qaeda were dismantled, they were disorganized, their command structure was totally broken. They were in Pakistan and we were acting against them successfully. All the people, Al-Qaeda people from number 3 downwards, all of them were apprehended in Pakistan. All those you see in Guantanamo or anywhere are all actions by ISI and Pakistan. All, I repeat, not one has been caught in Afghanistan by anyone else. So this was done very successfully in Pakistan. But then, unfortunately, the Al-Qaeda went down. Taliban resurgence started in 2004. It started because Pakhtun were not taken on board and this military success was not converted into a political success. Their resurgence started in 2004 and the resurgence carries on even now, unfortunately. So this was the third blunder where we could have utilized this 2-year window of opportunity and we failed. And now, after in 2011, we are trying to talk to Taliban now. Now, Taliban is not a monolith, by the way. So when we talk to Taliban, I don't really know which Taliban is anyone talking to. Mullah Omar is a Taliban. Siraj Haqqani is a Taliban commander. Gulbuddin Hikmatyar is Taliban. TTP of Pakistan is Taliban. TNSM of Pakistan is Taliban. Which Taliban are we talking to is not very clear. So therefore, we are in a complex situation now. What is the complexity now? There is Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. There is Taliban resurgence and dominant position is Taliban now. In Pakistan also, there are some Al-Qaeda, but mainly Taliban, Pakistani Taliban, who go across and fight in Afghanistan also, and also harbor Afghan Taliban. The third issue, as far as Pakistan is concerned, they try to spread their Talibanization into settled districts of Pakistan. The fourth issue is that there are Mujahideen within Pakistan, the groups which initially were oriented towards fighting Indian army in Kashmir, but they have developed a nexus with the Taliban. The fifth issue is that there is extremism within our society in certain areas. They are rising because they have developing a nexus with the Taliban. So this is the complexity of the situation in Pakistan, which we have to deal with. And each element, whether it is Al-Qaeda, who are foreigners, the military action is the only solution, Taliban of Pakistan, military, political, socio-economic requirement, expansion of Taliban, trying to spread obscurantist Talibanization, force is the only requirement, Mujahideen orientation towards Kashmir now involved with Taliban, resolution of Kashmir dispute, and also political action is the requirement. Extremism in our society, a long-term strategy of education, of enlightenment, of economic welfare is the issue, poverty alleviation. So this is the complexity of problem Pakistan faces. But I would be remiss if I did not point out what is there in India. There is Mujahideen activity in Kashmir, but there is a rise in the extremism in Muslim youth in India. And that is what Indians should realize themselves. The last bombing attacks in Bombay, the finding in India is that it had been by local Mujahideen. So there are local Mujahideen in India. What is the reason? Whether the reason is unequal treatment of the Muslims or their sense of alienation or whatever, it is for Indian government to find out and rectify. Because there is a tendency to develop a nexus of all these people with extremists in Pakistan and all that. Then, as if this is not enough, ladies and gentlemen, there is an ETIM, East Turkestan Islamic Movement in China. They have, many of them have come into our tribal agencies and Afghanistan to join hands with Al-Qaeda. Then this is not enough, there is AQIM, Al-Qaeda in Islamic Maghreb, Algeria, Mali, Al-Qaqab, Al-Qaeda in Arab Peninsula is Yemen and Somalia. The Al-Shabaab in Somalia. All trying to have underground nexus. Now this is the complexity of the situation. I don't want to create a doomsday scenario here, but certainly this is the complexity, and we must understand the entire complexity of the situation. Now within this, Pakistan-United States relations are terrible. They are at the lowest ebb. It's the most unfortunate thing. Because I say it is unfortunate because we have to have commonality of thought and action if we want to defeat terrorism and extremism, or if we want to combat terrorism and extremism. Now, one thing that I want to highlight here with full conviction, that one is this, at this, one has to look at the strategic plane in Pakistan. What is Pakistan's policy? What is Pakistan's overall strategy and direction as far as terrorism and extremism is concerned, or Taliban and Al-Qaeda are concerned? Certainly, it cannot be pro-Taliban, pro-Al-Qaeda. Why can't it be? Because Pakistan army has suffered over 3,000 dead. Because the same ISI, the much maligned ISI, has suffered about 350 operatives dead, killed through suicide bombings. By whom? By Taliban, by Al-Qaeda, the same enemy. And this much maligned ISI, may I also point out that this is the same ISI which has saved many lives around the world by unearthing a lot of plots. The major one which ISI unearthed was in 2005 when 10 airliners were on transatlantic flight were to be bombed. And it was ISI which unearthed it. And this issue of the containment of liquid, now that the rules that the airlines follow, that you cannot have 3 milliliters or something, 3 liters more liquid in your hand carry, is because of that. Because they were going to blow them up with liquid explosives. Who did this? ISI did it. So why I want to highlight, please, ISI is much maligned today. That they are the rogue elements. So therefore, is it possible that strategically they are pro-Taliban, those who are killing us? 35,000 civilians have died. This doesn't stand to logic. However, I would like to clarify, then what the hell is happening? We must understand there is a problem at the tactical, at the modalities, at the handling of situations, at the dealing with situations. There may be a misunderstanding. There may be a difference of opinion. But anyone who tries to convert this tactical mishandling and difference of opinion to reflect or to cast aspersion that ISI and army at the top level by design are facilitating, abetting, encouraging, arming maybe the Haqqani group to go across and kill United States soldiers and bomb US embassy, I think is divorced from reality, ladies and gentlemen. So I am very sad, may I say, that Admiral Mullen came here, I believe, and made certain remarks. Now when Admiral, a person of Admiral Mullen's stature says that Haqqani group is an extension of ISI, he means that the DGISI, therefore the army, is against United States, is abetting with the Haqqani group, is with the Taliban. That means Pakistan is the enemy. Pakistan is not the friend. Pakistan is not the coalition member. We have to be very, very discreet, very understanding, very accurate in this understanding. I think it is totally against the interest of the United States and Pakistan and the region and also the world, because it violates this, what I say as the unity of thought and action against Taliban, Al-Qaeda, and terrorists. Now, I would like to bring out why this has happened and what can we do to maybe bridge this problem. From United States' point of view, I would like to admit Pakistan needs to clarify two elements which are casting very negative aspersions and leading to this trust and confidence deficit. Number one, why was Osama bin Laden in Abbottabad, where he got killed? The issue is, where was there complicity or negligence? I would be prepared to answer questions. So with problem of limitation of time, I would only like to say that with all my honest conviction, it is a case of terrible negligence which ought to be investigated and punished. It is not a case of complicity. The second issue, but the onus of proving this to United States, which is, it's a very difficult thing to prove because nobody believes. But we have to still prove, because I know it to be truth, that it is not a case of complicity. The second issue is Siraj Haqqani, a group which is there in North Waziristan. Why is the army is not acting there? Now, again, the onus of clarifying lies on Pakistan. They must do it. And I would like to admit that they are not doing a good job of both these. They must prove to the world and to the United States, is there a problem? Do they have a different strategy to, as far as Siraj Haqqani is concerned? Is there a problem that the army is overstretched? Is there a problem that this enemy is too strong and we will hold back later, till later? They have to clarify why. But I would be remiss if I did not point out that there are some areas where United States should also understand Pakistan's sensitivity and also give comfort, I would say, to Pakistan. Number one is United States has decided to leave in 2014, leave Afghanistan. If even I was a leader there, I would have come and interacted. You let us analyze, you give me an analysis. What do you see when you leave Afghanistan? Are you leaving a stable Afghanistan or an unstable Afghanistan? Because based on that, I in Pakistan will have to take my own countermeasures. This is very important. If we leave Afghanistan in an unstable condition or not a fully stable condition, when I say fully stable militarily and politically, then I presume there are two possibilities. This is my personal analysis. Either Afghanistan goes back to 1989, when all ethnic groups were fighting against each other, or it goes down back to 1996, when it was Taliban, Pakhtun Taliban on one side, and Uzbek Tajik Hazara's Northern Alliance on the other side. In both cases, Pakistan has to fend for itself. And there is a different strategy required to deal with each, because its direct influence, impact, negative impact, adverse impact will be on Pakistan. So any leader in Pakistan must think of securing Pakistan's interest. So I think it's for United States to sit down with Pakistan and discuss these issues very seriously. The second element which needs clarification, and I know there are a lot of Indians maybe sitting here. Unfortunately, yes indeed, he's a good friend of mine. And I say, my bluntness doesn't mean that I'm very unpopular in India. I'm reasonably popular in India.
You were born in India, sir.
Yes, I was, yes.
You have Indian blood, like me.
Well, yes, I admit, yes indeed. Well, that is why I say that India and Pakistan must have peace. I am a strong, very strong believer we must have peace. Now, India is trying to create an anti-Pakistan Afghanistan. This is most unfortunate. And I am not saying this because I have some Indo-centric and I am anti-India. I know this through intelligence. I know this to be a fact. Today, and just to give you one proof, today in Afghanistan, Afghanistan's diplomats, the intelligence people, the security people, the army men, all go to India for training. I, in my time, was bending backwards, offering to President Karzai to send them to Pakistan. All our training institutions open, free of cost. Not one to date, has come to Pakistan. Now they go there, they come back, they get indoctrinated against Pakistan. And may I say, over the years since our independence, Afghanistan always has been anti-Pakistan because Soviet Union and India have very close relation in Afghanistan. And the intelligence agency, KGB, RAW and CUD of Afghanistan have always been in cooperation. I am talking since 1950s. So we must not allow this to continue, because then one must not grudge if Pakistan orders ISI to take countermeasures to protect its own interest. So I think this needs a rapprochement certainly between India and Pakistan, and rapprochement also between the two intelligence organizations, the RAW of India and ISI of Pakistan, because they have been on a confrontational course all through since 1950s, harming each other. So this is, I would say, and if I'm also allowed to, one rather minor, but still becoming very significant, when leadership from United States or anywhere says Pakistan has not done enough, we need to do more. Now this has become almost so annoying to a common man in Pakistan. We have suffered 35,000 dead, 3,000 soldiers killed, 350 ISI people killed, generals killed, generals' children killed. What more should Pakistan do? Yes, indeed, we are doing our best. We are the first victims of terrorism and extremism. At least don't keep saying that we need to do more. Yes, we need to do together. We must counter all these problems. Having said that, lastly, let me come to a little bit on Pakistan itself. Today, Pakistan is suffering. There is a dysfunctional government, rise of terrorism and extremism, rise of even law and order situation in Karachi, which is the economic hub. There is an economic collapse in Pakistan. There is political turmoil and also floods, etc. So Pakistan is in terrible shape. My dismay is that Pakistan has all the resources and all the potential to stand on its own feet. And I say this, it's my dismay, because in the 8 years that I governed, all the socio-economic factors were going up. Even if we see our strategic location, in the center, with West Asia and Gulf on the west, landlocked Central Asian republics, Afghanistan, yearning to reach out to the sea in our north, East China, West China to our northeast, India, South Asia to our east, we provide the connectivity for all trade and energy activity in the region. No energy, no trade within this region is possible without Pakistan's involvement. That is the strength of our strategic location. The other issue is that we are a country which is self-sufficient in water, self-sufficient in food, self-sufficient even in energy. We have hydroelectricity much more than our total requirement, double our total in requirement. We have mastered nuclear technology. We have tremendous energy through coal, through gas, alternate source. The only thing we lack maybe is oil. So we have to switch from thermal to all these. But all the capacity is certainly available. Tremendous amount of natural resources. So what is the problem? We are economically self-sustainable. The proof of it is that when I came into in 1999, we were a failed or a defaulted state. But in 2006, Pakistan was declared one of the N11, next 11 economically vibrant countries of the world. After the BRIC Four, Brazil, Russia, India, China, the BRIC Four, who are doing exceptionally well, Pakistan was one of the N11, next 11 countries of the world. So how did this happen? Did I have a magic wand or something? I did not. It was the potential and the resources of Pakistan itself, wherein we utilized our own resources, our own potential to control the budget imbalance, the budget deficit, the fiscal deficit, the balance of payment deficit, which was controlled by increasing our earning, reducing our expenditures. The problem that the United States is facing, and may I say that the debt to GDP ratio, which was at 103%, was reduced to 52%. That was how we turned the economy around. I don't want to get into the details. But the per capita income rose from $430 to over $1,000 in 6 years. So what is the problem again? Why is it that the same country, the same people, the same resources, in 99 we are a failed country, in 2006-07 we are N11, and now we are again going down, heading towards disaster again? The answer lies that there is a leadership vacuum. It is the leadership, it is the governance which fails Pakistan. And governance, government and leaders are thrown up through the political system, through the elections. It is here that we fail. No government elected through elections in a democratic way has ever done good governance for Pakistan. And when I say good governance, really the responsibility of every leader, welfare of the people, development of the state. These are the two things that I believe any leader and any government has to do. Otherwise, the people reject them. That is the problem of Pakistan. No good leadership, not doing welfare of the people and the development of the state. So therefore, the problem is in throwing up right leadership through the political process. And now we are heading towards another election in 2013. A year and a half away. If at all we don't bring about a political change, breaking the political status quo, people of Pakistan rejecting those who have been tried and tested and failed, we will continue on the path downward slide. So we have to produce another political alternative in Pakistan which can deliver, which can understand the problems of Pakistan, will have the courage to deal with these things, and is honest and enough to deal with Pakistan's problems with determination. It is for this reason that I, while I am very comfortable delivering lectures through Harry Walker Agency, which looks after my interests, paying me very well also, Not that I've charged anything here, but I'm very comfortable. I'm very comfortable for myself. But I have decided to join politics because there is a bigger cause than self, and that is Pakistan. And therefore, I've decided to join politics. We have to create either myself and my party a third political alternative, or in combination with other like-minded people, we have to do that. So I'm going to try to do that. And that is why I've entered politics, and that is why I've decided to go back to Pakistan in March 2012 or earlier, if I am to spring a military surprise and deception and go earlier than 2012. So that is what I intend doing. Whatever the... because I believe it's better to try and fail rather than go down without trying. And for the sake of the country, I will take further risks. That is all that I had to say. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. I'm prepared to ask.
We're going to take questions now. When I call on you, we'll try to bring a microphone, and then just please briefly say who you are. Let's start with this lady here in the fifth row, and then we'll come over here. So get a mic to each of them, and great, please.
My name is Aisha Khalid. I'm a TV reporter with Voice of America, broadcasting to Pakistan. My question is that few days ago on one of our shows, VOA's shows, English language show, you said that democracy is a mindset and that you did a lot of things which were pro-democracy. My question is, why has your party not been able to attract support from Pakistani public so far?
Right.
In this context.
Right. First of all, let me correct. I never said democracy is a mindset. I said dictatorship is a mindset. Yes. Dictatorship, because they always called me a dictator because I was in uniform, a man in uniform. But actually, I believe dictator is a mindset. It's not the dress that you wear. I believed always, and I continue to believe in democracy. And most of the civilian governments in Pakistan are the biggest dictators. The people of Pakistan know that they've been the biggest. So it's not a matter of whether I'm in uniform or not. I did so much for democracy, for nurturing democracy. And democracy, I do believe, does not start and end at having elections and a political government. It starts from there. How you govern is the essence of democracy. And that is what I did. Through empowerment of the people, empowerment of women, empowerment of minorities, freedom to the media, that is democracy, and I did all that. So therefore, I'm a strong believer in democracy. Now coming to your next question, why do the people are not in support? I would be mad if I go back without people's support. Obviously, I know how much support there is and how much there is not. I am keeping a pulse, and certainly there is support. Do you know my support in 2007, March 2007? It was 78%. Now, is it possible that in 1 year it dipped and there is no support at all? There is always a support. When I resigned from my presidentship, many, many people were crying in Pakistan. The six cameramen who were filming me or recording me, four of them were crying right in front of me, and it was a great distraction because I was speaking at that time. So let me tell you that there is support for me. There is certainly support for me in Pakistan. However, if I am to believe today that there is so much support that I'll win in the next election, I'll be too naive. So I am a realistic person. I am a realist. While I must not over-assess myself, I must not under-assess myself also. So I try to carry out my own self-assessment. There is support, and I am now trying to build that support through organizing my party. I've already done that at the four provinces. We have gone down and we have organizing committees in 82 of the 124 districts of Pakistan. And I have now told them to go down to 350 tehsils of Pakistan and to the 6,500 union councils of Pakistan. In 1 year, the achievements that I have done internationally in United States, UK, UAE, Canada, and internally in Pakistan, I think nobody else has done from scratch with a new party in place. So let me assure you, I am giving it a good try. I can never be sure that I'll develop that kind of support that I'll win alone, but I'll give it a good try.
My name is Judd Herriot. I'm a documentary filmmaker. When you are elected president in 2013, what will you take a new approach towards the problem, the festering problem in the Vale of Kashmir? Will you take a new strategy to try to resolve this with India? I'm referring now to the activities of Jashi Mohammed and Lashkar-e-Taiba. Will you make efforts to bring these two under control?
Yes. Thank you very much. Well, thank you very much when saying when you get elected, which means you are sure I'm going to get elected.
Yeah, you will be, yes.
Okay. So I thought you should have said if I get elected.
When you are.
Thank you very much, sir. Thank you very much for all your confidence in me. Well, on Kashmir, yes, indeed. Let me say that it was a passion with me to resolve disputes and bring India and Pakistan closer. It was in my time that there was so much of interaction, people-to-people interaction, that when we had a cricket match between India and Pakistan at Lahore, which was the hub of cricket and which has been quite anti-India, the people of Pakistan were cheering the Indian team. For the first time, it was unique. It was because I was encouraging the Indian team. I met them and I was encouraging this interaction. Now, the issue of Kashmir has to be resolved. Other than that, there is Sir Creek and Siachen also. They are minor. I think we took them to a stage, myself and Prime Minister Manmohan Singh, that they can be signed yesterday. It just needs leadership decision. Sign it and finish it off. Kashmir is the problem. We had moved forward on Kashmir because of certain four parameters that I laid down. It was my thinking. Demilitarization, graduated demilitarization, giving maximum self-governance, having an overwatch mechanism of India, Pakistan, Kashmiris, and also making the line of control irrelevant through opening routes, six routes through for trade and people-to-people movement. So we were moving forward on these lines. We need to do that again. So I don't have to reinvent the wheel. I'll do it again. Because I believe in peace. Because it is to the advantage of India and Pakistan. Socio-economic advantage of both the countries. So therefore, I am for peace. Now when we talk of Lashkar-e-Tayyaba, Jaish Mohammed, Hizbul Mujahideen, I had banned Jaish Mohammed and Hizbul Mujahideen, both of them, in my time. Lashkar-e-Tayyaba is a problem area because they have great public sympathy. They need to be dealt with in a sensitive manner. But they, yes, indeed, we will pull the rug from under their feet if we resolve the Kashmir dispute. The dispute is over. What are you doing? Pack up and go home. And but it's easier said than done. We need to handle them with care because they are very well organized. As I said, public support. When we had the earthquake in 2005, their branch organization called Jamaat-ud-Dawa was probably the best NGO and became popular there in Kashmir for their relief effort that they had. They were so well organized. And we couldn't ban them. And there were a lot of people who were suggesting, let's ban them and stop them from there. I said, if we do that, and if one of the Chinook helicopters, which were, I call them the angels of mercy, if they shoot one of them down, no relief will be possible in that area without the American Chinook. So let's go along with them. We have to handle these things with understanding and with care. And we would like to do that. Again,
General, I'd like to follow up on the Kashmir question because there was a lot of progress made in the back channel with India during your time, but what you said about and others say about now the importance of Afghanistan and the great concern that Pakistan has about India's role in Afghanistan, even if you then somehow formalize an agreement on Kashmir. Where would this Afghan concern then fit in the overall relation? Isn't that gotten more important in a way?
Yes. Well, I personally have always been believing that interstate relations are more to do with interpersonal relations between leaders. And very proudly can I say that why was there so much trust and confidence between United States and Pakistan when I was there, that was because I had excellent communication and interpersonal relations with President Bush and Colin Powell. I had, day before yesterday, I went for coffee with Colin Powell to his house, and we used to speak to each other very, very regularly. I could pick up the phone and talk to President Bush, which I used to. Now, this is the interpersonal relation. On Pakistan-India, I developed very good interpersonal relations with both Prime Minister Vajpayee and Prime Minister Manmohan Singh. May I also add, without any reservation, that I found both of them to be very good people. I found both of them very flexible, very sincere to reach peace, and we were moving forward. Now, with this relationship, I am sure we can address all issues. What I said about Afghanistan is certainly with full knowledge. Otherwise, in an audience where there are Indians sitting, I would not have mentioned anything which was in doubt. I know this, that this is happening. So this is unfortunate. But if the two leadership have relations, I am sure we will be able to address them to the common good of everyone. I think it is doable, but we need to address it. Yes, indeed. But it needs all three to have developed an understanding. Pakistan, Afghanistan, and India.
This lady here, and then I got to go back and forth too. So there's right by, yeah, there. Yeah. Go ahead.
Sorry.
No, right here. Go ahead.
Nancy Baer with the Pakistani Spectator. My question today is regarding Nawaz Sharif.
Nawaz Sharif.
Okay.
Your friend.
He was
my good friend.
He was twice democratically elected. He was very pro-business, relaxing the business laws so that Pakistan became very attractive to foreign investment, and which resulted in even more jobs for the people. And even today, he is one of the most popular, viable leaders and very loved by his people. So my question is, did it not concern you when you deposed him with no democratic process whatsoever that it would be viewed negatively by the international community?
Thank you very much. This is my favorite question. Let me tackle it. May I say, ma'am, your figures are totally distorted. 1999, I come on the scene. Pakistan is a failed and defaulted state. Do you know the FDI in Pakistan? $400 million. This is the investment coming to Pakistan. And do you know where we took it? $8.4 billion. Do you know our exports are stagnating? Do you know our revenue collection? Our revenue collection was at 408 billion rupees. Do you know where we took it? 1 trillion rupees. So this is the performance of Nawaz Sharif. The joblessness, poverty, do you know? And the poverty was at 34%. We brought it to 17%. And these figures are not ISI figures, by the way. United Nations figures. So please find out from United Nations whether this is true. And you are talking of a person who did this? I'm amazed that you... Please correct your figures. And don't believe me. Go and find out. On each. Now, I'm not saying anything. Go and find out about industry. Where was telecommunication in Pakistan? We had 2.9% tele-density, only 500,000 or 600,000 mobile telephones. Do you know what it is now? Our tele-density is over 70%, and there are 80 million mobile telephones now. So this was his performance, and it was his government of 3 years. And do you know what people were doing? Because I was the army chief then. They were all coming to my office and telling me, when are you going to take over, when Pakistan finishes? This is what they were telling me. So please understand what was happening in Pakistan. And now, coming to the second part, that he's a very popular man. Well, yes, indeed, let me admit that the man, when he came back, when Benazir came, she got assassinated, we had to get him back, he gained in popularity. Yes, you are right to that extent. He had gone up in popularity. But then with the wonderful governance that they are doing in Punjab province, the biggest province, where there are power outages for hours at end, villages get only 2 hours of electricity, and there is total misgovernance in Punjab, there is a sharp decline in his popularity. He has no base in the three smaller provinces, that is Sindh, Frontier, and Baluchistan. In Punjab, in South Punjab, he is almost out. So his base is North and Central Punjab. So, I mean, I could talk for hours. Let me cut it down. He is not as popular as you think.
Thank you.
And also, may I say, I call him a closet Taliban. He appeases extremists. There are extremist groups in Punjab who are now his political partners. So he will be a bigger disaster if he, God forbid, comes in governance. I am very sure he will never, if he comes to governance in Pakistan. Bigger disaster than the present situation.
And we will be happy to host a debate between you and him here in Washington if you like.
Let me assure you, he will never come.
I know.
I stand. You call him, I will sit here right before and let him answer.
Wait. All right, I'll call on you, but we're going to have, it'll get fun. Why call on this gentleman back?
Thank you, Professor Berkowitz. Good afternoon, sir. My name is Nissim Rubin. I'm with the American Jewish Committee, and we were privileged to give a donation of $50,000 during the Pakistan earthquake and partner with the American Association of Physicians of Pakistani Origin and the Washington Hebrew Congregation to send 100,000 kosher meals to the earthquake-affected area. And in recent years, we have reached out to the Indian American community, tried to reach out to the Pakistan American community. Sir, when you were...
Which community are you talking about?
I'm the Indian American and the Pakistan South Asian communities. Sir, when you were president, your foreign minister, I believe Mr. Kasturi, met with the then Israeli foreign minister, Mr. Silvan Shalom, in Ankara, trying to open, because, India has traditional strong ties for the Palestinian cause, strong ties with the Arab world, and now growing relations with Israel. And the Israelis and many American Jews saw Pakistan as a bridge between the Israel and the Jewish world and the Islamic world. And sir, you also attended a kosher dinner.
Is there a question?
So you attended a kosher dinner with Jewish leaders in New York. Would you reach out and see Pakistan being that bridge between Israel and the Jewish world?
Were you the one I met at the American Jewish Congress when I addressed them? Okay. Now, yes, indeed. Now, I personally believe that we have to bring peace not only to the region, but to the whole world. And therefore, I even started a strategy, an idea of enlightened moderation, which I proposed at the OIC summit in Kuala Lumpur, which is a double pincer or two-pronged strategy. One prong to be delivered by the Muslim world, reject terrorism and extremism, go on the socio-economic path. And for the West and United States, the prong to be delivered, solve political disputes which bedevil Muslim world and also assist in the socio-economic development of Muslim world. Now, within this strategy, I personally believe that we must have peace. If we want to have peace, we have to resolve the Palestinian-Israeli dispute. This holds the key to Al-Qaeda and all this activity of Hezbollah, Hamas, Al-Fatah, etc. And also even maybe Al-Qaeda, they are mainly politically indoctrinated or motivated people. Those who did carried out the 9/11, who were they? They were probably people who were antagonized at this Israel-US relations and anti-Palestinian attitudes around. So as far as I'm concerned, as far as Pakistan is concerned, I thought we need to have balanced relations. And I personally commented once that we need to review our relations with Israel as we progress forward on the resolution of Palestinian-Israeli dispute. Towards this end, I even came and addressed the American Jewish Congress. Towards this end, I requested the Turkish president to invite the foreign minister of Israel to Turkey, and I will send my foreign minister. They should meet so that there is progress towards, and if we can contribute to the Palestinian-Israeli dispute resolution, I would like to play a role. And may I also inform this August gathering, in 2006, I initiated a different peace process. And that was, I thought, that on one side, in the Muslim world, United States on Israeli side and dealing with peace maybe has become unacceptable to the Muslim world. Therefore, there's a requirement of maybe European Union and Mr. Solana, the Secretary General, who is held in certain esteem in Pakistan, in the Muslim world, to play a role on one side. And on the Muslim side, I thought instead of Arabs who have always been dealing, and maybe they failed to reach a conclusion, we include non-Arab Muslim players. And that I thought was Turkey, Pakistan, Malaysia, and Indonesia. And I went around to do this, to develop this team or this group to deal with Palestine-Israel dispute. I thought this may be a different approach, and maybe because Israel would have more confidence in the four that I've spoken of, and Muslim world will have more confidence on Solana, Mr. Solana, and we could make some progress. But I think we have to think out of the box, and I am for peace with, as far as Pakistan is concerned, with all countries, and trying to resolve all disputes, political disputes.
We'll take two questions at a time. But I know we're running out of time, if that's okay with you. And I've got a woman here. And then
well, I will take my time because I was late. So therefore, I owe it to them, whatever question, whatever time you want to take.
Thank you.
Hello, Suzanne Kelly from CNN. Can you tell me if you believe that Pakistan is doing enough when it comes to working with the international community on securing its nuclear facilities, or should it be doing more?
On the nuclear facility? Mm-hmm. Pakistan is what? What did you say?
Working enough with the international community, say the IAEA, on securing these facilities, or should they be more open?
Pakistan is very, very sensitive. First of all, Pakistan's nuclear capability, everyone must understand, is a pride to every man in the street. Number two, that Pakistan's nuclear capability is in direct relation to the threat perception, to the existential threat that Pakistan has always faced, like Israel. So therefore, we are nuclear. Now, unfortunately, in Pakistan, a perception has got created that United States or many other powers that be are for Pakistan to be denuclearized. That goes totally against Pakistan's interest, and the people of Pakistan will never allow it because it is unfair also. And now, coming as far as IAEA and custodial controls, what the world ought to be interested is, are they secure? Yes, indeed, it is unfortunate for Pakistan that there was proliferation by an important personality like Dr. A.Q. Khan. That was most terrible, and we suffered in our prestige. But may I say, after 2000, when I came on the scene, the first thing that I did was establish custodial controls. In that we had an NCA, National Command Authority, on top. We created an SPD, Strategic Planning Division, a big secretariat headed by a lieutenant general who heads it even now. And we took away all the autonomy from the science organization, especially of finance and security. The two which were given to them, money used to be given to them and no questions asked. Security was their own, and therefore, since nobody was overseeing, this proliferation was possible. When we took away these two, proliferation is no more possible. And then, while all these assets were held by the science organization at that time, I took over those assets and I created an Army Strategic Force Command, a strength of about 20,000 of men of the Army. It's the core of the Army with two divisions, with a number of brigades, with a number of regiments who physically hold all our assets. So they are no more. While the development is by science organization, the holding is by the Army. And the Army has dispersed them and put them in places where nobody can access. And may I also add that a lot of misperception is there that when India and Pakistan were on a confrontation course in 2002, so they used to ask me, your finger is on the button and nuclear button and all that. There is no finger on the nuclear button in India-Pakistan context. It's not like Warsaw Pact and NATO. In our case, thank God, including India, our weapons are not mated, in that the bomb is separate and the missile is separate. Even in during the confrontation, they were not mated. So there is nothing like an impulsive man pressing some button, and like in NATO and Warsaw Pact scenario, where you have to maybe react in seconds. That is not the case. So let me, for this long answer, let me say that Pakistan's nuclear capability is our existential requirement. It is the pride of Pakistan. We will go along with the world, certainly, on all safeguards as applicable to others of the world. Do not please single out Pakistan. It will not be acceptable to Pakistan.
General, may I ask a follow-up, which is, if you're elected president, you would be a civilian leader in Pakistan, but it's a nuclear program that's always been controlled by the army. So by what process would you then, for example, have a policy and make a decision to decide, do you have enough fissile material, do you have enough weapons, and as a civilian, would you be able to have actual authority in that discussion?
Because I've commanded the army for 40 years, they can never forget that. I fought wars with them, I faced dangers with them, but that aside, that's not the case. It is not correct that the army controls everything. We have made the National Command Authority. The chairman is the president of Pakistan. The prime minister is there. 5 important ministers are there, and 4 chiefs are there, Army, Navy, Air Force, and Chairman Joint Staff. This is the organ, and the president commands it. Now, even if you see historically, when we started this program, it was started probably after India exploded its first bomb in 1974, because that made our military strategy, throughout was a strategy of minimum defensive deterrence, quantified into Army, Navy, Air Force. But in 1974, when India exploded its bomb, this minimum defensive deterrence, although in place in the conventional, became untenable in the unconventional. Therefore, Pakistan decided to go nuclear.
Well, it actually decided in 72 after the war with Bangladesh. But
after?
In 72, January 72, after the 71 war is when the program started.
Well, the program, nuclear program, was always there.
Right.
But to go nuclear, to make bombs, was after this day of Dr. A.Q. Khan, enrichment of uranium, etc., started in 1977 or 78, etc. Now, that was, now at that time, since secrecy was required, it was under the president of Pakistan, who happened to be also a military man, General Ziaul Haq. But when he died, it was a civilian president, Ghulam Isaak Khan, who was overseeing, but then he used the army commander, army chief, to assist him. So it has been, the course has been following a normal course, but it is not that the army chief is the boss of Army Strategic Force Command, who hold the weapons. But the development, etc., is very much under, through the Strategic Planning Division, which is headed by a lieutenant general. He's a retired lieutenant general now,
right,
but it is overseen by the NCA. So I think this is the best practice that we acquired from the world, and that is what we've done. And I did this in 2000, by the way. I take credit for that.
Yeah, I know you did. Thank you. This gentleman here, and then Seema back there.
Thank you very much, Raghubir Goyal, India Global Nation Today. Thank you, Mr. President. I don't know how to address you, general, a great general, or a great president, whatever, or maybe both.
Whatever name you give me, I remain the same.
Thank you, Mr. President. I must say one thing, that recently in some think tanks, including Atlantic, some of the speakers were backing you as far as economic progress in Pakistan took place under your leadership was concerned, and also peace between India and Pakistan during your administration. My question is here that as far as Afghanistan is concerned, Afghanistan's President Karzai always accused Pakistan of sending terrorism or Taliban or Al-Qaeda across the border into Afghanistan. But now, recently, last week, what he said was, if there is a war between Pakistan and U.S., then he or Afghanistan will back up Pakistan, not the United States, after even getting all the billions of dollars and getting eliminated terrorism. And second, Mr. President, as far as Pakistan-U.S. relations are concerned, the survey in Pakistan shows that number one enemy of Pakistan, according to Pakistani people, is not India, but the United States, after getting all the billions of dollars. What can you make, Mr. President, out of these things? And also, one more thing, Osama bin Laden was found in your backyard, and you were the ruler that time, whether you knew or not, sir.
Yes, yes, yes. Very good. Thank you very much. firstly, Karzai's statement. First of all, let me thank him for the first time giving a pro-Pakistan statement. But however, the statement that he will support Pakistan against the United States is most preposterous, I would say. I find this idea itself very preposterous. How can they, is he visualizing some kind of war between the United States and Pakistan? It's ridiculous and preposterous. The thought of it is preposterous. So therefore, I wouldn't like to even answer this. I find this a very, very strange idea. Who has propounded this idea? And God forbid, this can never happen. So why comment? And thank you very much. Please look after the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. That is enough. Don't support Pakistan. Pakistan will look after itself. The second issue was
the survey in Pakistan about U.S.
Yes.
And India.
You said about Osama bin Laden being found in
No.
The United States, antipathy against United States.
Right.
Yes, the enemy. Yes, yes. Now that is unfortunate. While there is a dichotomy in Pakistan, unfortunately, if you go to the masses level, yes, there is a great antipathy against United States, which has developed since 1989. As I said, till 1989, we were strategic partners. Everything was going through Pakistan. And there was no problem. So it is beyond 1989 that things have happened. Everything that happened, whether the abandonment, where there was a sense of betrayal in the people of Pakistan. Do you know that 9/11, when I joined the coalition, which was a difficult decision, the question that was asked from me everywhere that I went, what makes you think that we will again not be betrayed and ditched by United States? This is the question that they used to ask me. So this is the unfortunate reality of events, and then India's very partisan approach on nuclear issue, which I said is the sensitivity of the man in the street. Partisan against Pakistan and very pro-India. While Pakistan has developed nuclear bomb because of its existential threat, India has developed a nuclear bomb. I don't know why. What for? Is there a threat from somebody? Or is there an idea of projecting your power in the region and in the world? So it's the approach is totally different. Our nuclear is defensive. Your nuclear is maybe offensive. Now, yet Pakistan is being told to control and stop and backroll its nuclear program. So unfortunately, the people of Pakistan have developed this antipathy. But at the government level, may I say, at the leadership level, at the intellectual level, I think everyone understands the importance of Pakistan-U.S. relations. Pakistan-U.S. relations are very broad in context. Not only is there military cooperation or terrorism and extremism cooperation against that, but there is a great socio-economic element in that. Our trade and investment interests are there. So everyone understands that Pakistan-United States relations have to be strong. It is the masses who are more emotional, I would say, and sentimental that because of these events, there is an antipathy which needs to be corrected, frankly. I personally believe it has to be corrected. It will take time and good leadership. And your third, there were three questions.
Osama bin Laden, were you surprised or
yes. I mean, Osama bin Laden was in Abbottabad. Yes, he was there for 5 years. First of all, I am not fully convinced that he was there for 5 years, frankly. Unless there is some proof given, for 5 years he was there. I'll relate a joke after something that I'm going to tell you. That if he was there for 5 years, 2 years was in my tenure. Now, why I say there was no complicity? As far as I'm concerned, I am 500% sure that I did not know, whether anyone believes it or not. So therefore, I am clear that there was no complicity. And I am also clear that the army and ISI could not have hidden this from me, because I am from them and they are from me. And if at all there was some misdoing at the top level, I am sure the second, third, fourth tier officers who are in very much in touch with me, who have always been, would have come and told me that this is not possible, that ISI and army could do anything of what my policy was not, whether they were not following the policy. So there was no complicity, and I didn't know, frankly.
President, thank you very much. We keeping you. Thank all of you for hanging in there. And,